Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 318. Wednesday, November 14th, 2018.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, two podcasts in 2 days. This one is a conversation I mentioned in the last podcast. It's one that I recorded last week with Irv Mills. Irv is a blogger. He is also somebody who listens to this podcast and has, I think, he's been listening to the Sea Realm podcast since before there was a Sea Realm Vault podcast. So he knows what I'm interested in here. In fact, he's better versed in what I've said in some regards than I am myself, particularly past conversations on the topic of Charles Murray and intelligence. So this conversation by itself is an hour and 17 minutes. I'm not going to add much to the length of the podcast with commentary up front or at the end, really, even though I did just listen to the whole thing and took a fair amount of notes. I will use those notes in crafting episode number 319, which I think will be a solo show, maybe with some clips of things taken from elsewhere that I will comment upon. But for now, here is my conversation with Irv Mills. I'm talking with Irv Mills, who is a longtime friend of the Sea Realm and a blogger and somebody that I would describe as a doomer, although you've said that that's less true now than it has been in the past.
Yes. Lately, I've been calling myself a collapsnik, not a doomer, which is maybe a fine point, but my intention there is to imply that, I think our civilization's likely to collapse, I also think that is to some extent survivable, and it doesn't mean near-term extinction or any of that sort of thing.
Well, that is not the topic that we have convened here to discuss.
No, it certainly isn't.
You contacted me because you have been, I think, reading The Bell Curve by Charles Murray.
Yes.
And thinking about the topic, you asked me about episode numbers for conversations that I had with Doug Lane. So I think you have revisited some Sea Realm or Sea Realm Vault conversations with Doug on that topic. I have not. So I think all of this is much fresher in your mind than it is in mine. So I will let you lead the discussion. Basically, tell me what it is that has got you thinking on this topic and what you think needs to be addressed or reframed or corrected.
Well, it was Sea Realm Podcast 514. Which I think is one of those ones that's lost in the changeover to your new web hosting. But where you were talking to Doug Lane about Sam Harris's podcast with Charles Murray. And that brought up the whole issue, well, two issues really, the bell curve and everything that's in it. But I think what Sam Harris really wanted to talk to Charles Murray about was free speech, because the topic of what happened when Murray was invited to speak at Middlebury College, I believe it was.
Right here in Vermont, yeah.
Basically, he never got to speak.
You know, I was reminded of Middlebury and its reputation here in Vermont. I was talking to an older gentleman who told me, you know, before the Charles Murray debacle, that he had run into a student from Middlebury and that she was delightful. And just apropos of nothing, he said that Middlebury was the place where the children of hyper wealthy people go to discover what hobby they will pursue over the course of their lives, as they will have no need to ever earn a living. So that was my first association with Middlebury College. So I think, I don't know how true that is, but I think it does give the listeners some indication of the background of the students who go there.
Yeah. And that might have something to do, you think, with their reaction to Charles Murray.
I do indeed. But please continue. Actually, do you have the bell curve with you?
I do.
What is the full title on the book?
The Bell Curve, Intelligence and Class Structure in American Life.
Okay. I was looking at it on Goodreads earlier, and it had a longer title that included something about public policy. But maybe that's an alternate.
Let's look inside and see. No, not on the edition I've got anyway. Although certainly there's a chapter at the end where the authors discuss what they think public policy should be on various matters relating to intelligence.
Actually, no, I'm looking at the cover now, and it is the same title that you read. I was just remembering, I think, a blurb about the book as being part of the title.
Right. Yeah.
I'm looking at Goodreads, and it summarizes the book as the controversial book linking intelligence to class and race in modern society and what public policy can do to mitigate socioeconomic differences in IQ, birth rate, crime, fertility, welfare, and poverty.
Yeah. And it may surprise you that it's not what the book has to say about class structure and the effect of IQ on it that I object to. I do object to some of what's in the book, though. And I guess the first thing would be the idea, which is put across by Murray and Herrnstein as a fact, a solid, well-accepted scientific fact, which is that a large amount of intelligence is determined by heredity. And then further on in the book, it talks about how attempts through education to positively affect people's intelligence have failed, in essence. And, I got doing some reading, and neither of those assertions are anywhere near as solid as Charles Murray would have us believe, is what I found out. So I think that means that some of the conclusions he reaches from them are not as solid as he thinks.
Just in general terms, how would you describe the project of the Bell Curve? What were Murray and his co-authors' aims, and how did they go about addressing them?
Maybe I'm reading more in here than's really there, but Charles Murray himself, and I think in the afterword, which is new in this edition of the book, admits right out that he is a libertarian. Mm-hmm. And I hope you won't take this personally, because I know you have a lot of interest in libertarianism, I guess you'd say. But
an ugly word, libertarianism.
It is an ugly word. A lot of syllables.
Too many syllables, yeah.
Yeah. It seems to me, in one of the chapters very near the end of the book, have a look at the index here, the table of contents, rather, after having looked at how intelligence affects class structure, part four, living together, and he has some ideas on how we might deal with the problems. What he observes, and I think it's probably true, is that say around the start of the 20th century, the people at different cognitive levels with different IQs were still rubbing shoulders in day-to-day life in most circumstances. And since then, because of the changes that have gone on, the classes, if we can call them that, distinguished by IQ, have drifted farther and farther apart. And he sees that as a problem. I would agree. And then he has some ideas of what might fix that. But they're suspiciously libertarian ideas, and in the worst sense of that word. I mean, I was recently reading, and it's probably still up in my browser on my other computer behind me here, but a movement of libertarian people who are essentially going to try and take over New Hampshire. Have you heard of that?
The Free State Project is ancient, many decades old. New Hampshire seems to be going the other way. New Hampshire, I mean, I live in Vermont, which is right next door to New Hampshire, and ideologically, they're pretty distinct from one another. Here on the west side of the river, we tend to be pretty blue, and over on the east side of the river, it's just the reverse. But New Hampshire has a Democratic governor right now. I think they have two Democrat senators, and they voted for Clinton in 2016. So it's not as stark as, you know, the usual comparison with Vermont would have you believe.
Yeah.
But, no, the whole notion that all the libertarians in the U.S. are going to move to one state and then have a majority there is a decades-old pipe dream and nothing worth worrying about.
Well, I'm at some remove from the situation anyway, so I wasn't worrying. But what I noticed in the article...
Not even worth taking seriously is what I mean by not worth...
Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't. but what I did notice is the guy who was writing the article had gone and to some sort of conference these people were having and interviewed people, and he noticed what struck him was the range of different sorts of libertarians he met.
That would be another problem with the Free State, is that as soon as all the libertarians got together, they'd factionalize pretty quickly. There are some very strong divisions within people who identify as libertarian.
It sounded like that it's already happening. And at the one end, he was quoting the name eludes me, but some French fellow from the probably 1800s who I think maybe coined the term libertarian, but he was, to my way of thinking, more of an anarchist. And that's what the guy in the article said. Okay. And then you have the other end of the spectrum, at least the way it's in my head at the moment, is that you have people like Ayn Rand and somebody like Charles Koch, maybe, who I guess are libertarians.
Charles Koch funds the Cato Institute, which is an explicitly libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C., which is dependent on the Koch brothers for its funding. Ayn Rand, a lot of libertarians take inspiration from her writing, but she positively hated the Libertarian Party. And, you know, the first time they put up a candidate, it was to run against Richard Nixon, and she explicitly endorsed Richard Nixon. She considered the Libertarian Party to be just a bunch of hippies and, you know, dope smokers and, you know, nobody she would take seriously or want to associate with. So it is odd that a lot of libertarians are big Ayn Rand fans.
It is. It seemed to me in reading the bell curve, especially the section at the end, that Charles Murray would be more of Charles Koch's kind of libertarian. And he very much against affirmative action, and his advice for how, you know, communities of lower class people who, according to him, have low IQs, how they could, things could be done so they can help themselves rather than any sort of welfare state having to help them. And I'm sure I do gather that libertarians are very much against anything that smacks of a welfare state.
Well, Charles Murray is a big advocate for universal basic income.
Is he?
Yes.
Yeah. I've heard you talking, listened to you talking on your podcast a lot about the universal basic income, and it seems to me that's sort of a way that rich people can ease their consciences in a simple way, because we're just do away with the whole welfare state and send everybody in the whole country a check every month, yep. And that'll take care of everything.
Which obviously it won't. And basically you're taking the money away from the people who need it to distribute it amongst everybody.
Yes.
You know, yeah, that's ridiculous to me. Now, there's not everybody who advocates universal basic income thinks that it should replace all existing targeted programs. The version that libertarians and particularly Charles Murray advocate does say, yes, scrap all existing programs designed to help people in need and just give everybody money. To me, I think that's a recipe for, you know, greatly increased human misery in a short period.
Yeah, I agree. Anyways, so that I suspect there is a political or ideological agenda behind the bell curve. I don't know whether Charles Murray would object to me saying that or not, but I don't care a whole lot. That's my conclusion upon reading it. But I guess, was it Thursday night? Yeah, it must have been Thursday night. I sat down and listened to the two C-Round Velt podcasts that are available, 246 and 248, where you and Doug Lane were discussing this, especially 246. 248 got sidetracked in many, many different tangents, all of them interesting. But anyway, and it seemed to me that not to be critical, okay, but and it's, it may sound like it, but the thing is, my thought when I listened to Sam Harris interviewing Charles Murray was, oh, is that so? Really? I wonder what the current scientific consensus on IQ is. Because Murray clearly felt that he's what they call a hereditarian, which is almost as bad as a libertarian kind of thing, as far as too many syllables, but just clearly believes it's all hereditary. And Sam didn't question him on that, which I found a little surprising. If you look on the internet for criticism of that podcast, the main one is that Sam Harris really softballed it. He didn't question him on anything. Didn't hold him to task at all. And in that podcast, Harris says he's going to do that on atheist subjects, okay? Harris and Murray would differ on the role of religion in society. Well, fine. But also, what about just Mr. Murray, are you presenting something that other scientists agree with, or are you off on your own little ideological thing? So I started doing some looking on the internet. It's wonderful that way. You don't have to be, isolated from everything. And I sent you a link to an article in Vox, and the title of it is Charles Murray is Once Again Peddling Junk Science About Race and IQ. And they go through, I think you were reading this earlier today.
I didn't quite get through it. I read most of it, though. I think I've got a couple paragraphs there at the end yet to get through.
And they say his logic is flawed and so on and so forth. But what for me, what was most important about this article was it had a bunch of links to scholarly articles responding in some cases to the bell curve. And there's one which I've got here called Intelligence, Knowns and Unknowns. And it is the report of a task force established by the American Psychological Association in response to the bell curve. And it was put out, the bell curve came out in 1994. This came out in February of 96. And what it you maybe can tell from the title, Intelligence, Knowns and Unknowns, if you had to sum it up, was it's questioning whether the state of the art at that point really knows what Murray was saying it did. And their conclusion was no, it doesn't. And that there are a bunch of unknown things which he was taken as given. Okay, that confirmed what I suspected. But a number of years later, another paper came out, and the lead author is Richard E. Nisbet, and it's called Intelligence, New Findings and Theoretical Developments. And it, again, is a review of what the scientific consensus is in the year it came out. It came out in 2012 on the subjects of the bell curve was addressing. And by that time, 18 years after the bell curve was published, quite a bit of studies had been done, and a lot of it seeming to contradict what Murray would have us believe. I mean, his interview with Sam Harris was spring of 2017, 5 years after this article came out, and he still holding that the heritability of IQ is the overpowering thing that determines one's intelligence. And just ain't so, as near as I can tell from what I'm reading. I mean, hey,
well, I'm going to like... The fact that you can find a couple of articles that support that point of view, does that lead you to believe that that is the consensus in the field?
Well, the thing is, that's a concern. And some of the other articles that I'm reading are... you'd say, well, okay, this guy's done this research and he's expressing an opinion, but other people may disagree with him, and it's a soft science. So, right. But this article and the other one that I was referring to are surveys of the literature. So they're, yes, they do purport, at least, to be a representation of what the current consensus is at the time they were written. So yeah, it's my answer to that is, yeah, I think they are. Not just a matter of finding a couple of articles, but a couple of articles that are a survey of the literature and by creditable psychologists saying, okay, we've looked at it and here's what we think it is. What is the consensus in 2012? And the idea that heredity is the whole thing is much less creditable at this point. And interestingly, in a certain specific way, and that is that if you look at the whole range of socioeconomic status, you'll find that heritability at the upper end of that, what you'd call upper class people, is the main factor in determining the IQ of the next generation of rich folks, I guess I could say
that again.
Okay, that for upper class people, and this is socioeconomic status I'm talking about here when I say upper class.
Mm-hmm. Not classy folks.
Well, I guess you can be classy and poor, but no. But we're socioeconomic-wise. Yes, for those people, heredity is the major factor in determining IQ. For people at the other end of the socioeconomic class spectrum, poor people, it's not. In fact, heredity has hardly any role at all, and it is their environment, which usually is quite bad as far as fostering the growth of intelligence. And there's a sort of a parable, if you will, that Murray himself brings out early in the bell curve, and which he mentioned to Sam Harris, and that is, okay, if you had a handful of corn and you strew it on the ground in Iowa, you'd find that it probably grew pretty well and realized the potential of its genetics. You take that same corn, it's good corn, you take it to the Mojave Desert and throw it on the sand, and it doesn't do near as well, okay? And Murray himself says, yes, this is true. To that extent, the environment determines IQ, if you will, or yield of the corn in that case. But what Murray, I think, is missing, and I suspect this is something, he's an upper-class guy himself. He doesn't know what life at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale is like. And life for people at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale is very similar to life for corn in the desert. And that's what the findings seem to say. I have another article here. Socioeconomic status modifies heritability of IQ in younger children. And that's what they found. It's not a straightforward relationship when you graph heritability against socioeconomic status, you find it's not linear. And to me, that says a great deal. And the other issue that this one, New Findings in Theoretical and Theoretical Developments in Intelligence, talks about is that indeed, if you take, for instance, children from low socioeconomic status homes who at a young age get adopted into upper class homes, their intelligence increases by almost one standard deviation, about 17 points of IQ, I think that amounts to. So it would seem that not only is heritability not the whole story, but it's possible to change people's intelligence or young people's intelligence. So, and that, in my opinion, would sure determine what the policy should be government-wise on what we do here. And there's another book that I ended up reading, and where is it in the stack here? Have I done with, there it is. And this is by Richard E. Nesbitt, the lead author of that one article.
What's the title of the book?
The title is Intelligence and How to Get It. And the subtitle is Why Schools and Cultures Count. And well, it doesn't specifically set itself up to debunk the bell curve. It does mention it and address many of the things that Nisbet thinks Murray got wrong. And it specifically looks like Murray specifically said that all the efforts that there have been to change schooling or preschooling have failed. They've shown that there's no permanent effect. And Nisbet says, well, actually, that's not true. He looks at a number of different cases that have been where there was an attempt to adjust the way schooling was done, or where there were programs helping mothers with preschoolers and so forth, and some of them didn't work. Some of them did. And I guess probably you'd say that, more work needs to be done to perhaps, before we get to the point where we can say, well, this is what you need to do, so that the lower classes don't stay, how shall I put this, dumb, I guess. But because that's what the bell curve seems to me to say, that you lower caste people are, on the average, statistically speaking, a good standard deviation dumber than rich people. And the same, and there's a chapter in the bell curve talking about the effect ethnicity and race has on this. And again, he says, right out, black people in the States are about a standard deviation lower in IQ than white people. And Latin people are not quite that much, but almost as much. And Asian people are a little bit higher on some parts of it. But is this because of their heredity, or is this because of the culture they're living in? I guess you can tell by this point what I think about that.
What's the practical upshot of that?
Well, what Nisbet's saying is that you can do something about it. Murray was saying you can't do something about it. Affirmative action, as an example, where universities give minorities a leg up as far as getting in. He says that doesn't work, does more harm than good. And Nisbet doesn't agree with that. That would be one example. And the other thing about spending money on public schools and preschool programs in an effort to enrich the environment of low socioeconomic status children, Murray would say that's just a waste of effort. And Nisbet would say, no, it's not. It can make a big difference. So
if you put it as starkly as that, if you said, Charles Murray, I understand you to be saying that enriching the educational experience of children is not worth the effort, do you think he would agree with that?
I do.
Really? I'd be interested to put that question to him just like that.
I can't
imagine that he would.
I think, well, he'd probably try to weasel out of it, because I've stated it in a pretty bald-faced way. But quite a bit of what he's saying in the bell curve, yeah, he looks at that. And I'm not going to say he was cherry picking, but certainly the studies that were available in 1994, the ones he presents in the bell curve, say that, no, it's a wasted effort. There was no lasting effect on these kids.
What I find compelling about Charles Murray's presentation is that he says technological civilization, particularly now that it's largely digital, and when intellectual and cognitive work is much more highly rewarded than physical work, has turned into a sorting machine where it's sorting people for intelligence. And regardless of whether it's heritable or not, if you go to a prison and you do, you know, you hand out IQ tests, you're going to find that prisoners are testing much lower, their scores are lower, than if you take that same test to Google or Apple or a Wall Street bank and, you know, and have people there do IQ tests. So regardless of whether it's poor childhood education or, you know, an impoverished childhood environment in terms of stimuli and opportunities to develop, or whether there is a strong inherited component, regardless of, you know, what accounts for the IQ, the fact is that someone's IQ is about the most reliable predictor of their life outcomes in our society right now. And as I understand Charles Murray, he's saying that's not a good thing, that we need to correct for that. Otherwise, we are going to have a very stratified society in terms of outcome, and it's largely going to correlate with differences in IQ. And, you know, I think about my parents. My father was good with words, and he was horrible at science and math. I mean, utterly useless. My mother was just the opposite. She was very good. She, you know, she had a master's in chemistry. She was working on her PhD in chemistry when she got pregnant with me and dropped out of college so that my father could continue to get his bachelor's degree. But, you know, he was born at the right time. He was coming up during the post-World War II boom, and he basically coasted into a comfortable middle-class existence, even though, you know, he wasn't particularly good at a lot of the things that you have to be good at in today's world in order to do well. And he attributed his own success basically to, you know, good moral virtue and, you know, hard work. And he just didn't seem to be that hardworking to me. And I think about my two children. One of them is very much like my mother in that he's very good at math and very good at science, but he has crippling social anxiety. He is not good at talking to people. He can't bring himself to talk to a stranger. And my other son is more gregarious, but has absolutely no aptitude, demonstrated aptitude for math or related skill sets. And the idea, and I myself, you know, I took an IQ test as a grad student, and the person who administered the test said that the disparity between my math and spatial skills and my verbal skills was the widest she'd ever seen. And it just seems unlikely to me that my two children, who have the same two parents and who have the same environment that they've been brought up in, have such differing outcomes in terms of what they're good at and what they're not good at, without some genetic component being there to, you know, to account for it. It seems like an equally unhelpful mental strategy to say, oh, all of the differences that people demonstrate, which seem to be pretty fundamental to who they are really changeable. If I really were to put my mind to it, I could be a programmer. I could go get a job at Google. You know, this person who over here who seems tone deaf, if they really tried, they could be, you know, a piano prodigy, or they could be a really good singer. That there is, you know, there is no genetic lottery. There is no gift given to some at birth and, you know, a challenge placed upon others at birth. That really, you know, if we were to just level the playing field and everybody tried their best, that we'd get pretty much the same outcome across the board. And that just seems completely counter to, you know, all of my worldly experience.
I'd agree with you, believe it or not. But the distinction I'm trying to make is that you were had a middle class upbringing.
You would
call it that, you know. Okay, so the corn in your case was planted in Iowa,
right? But each kernel was not the same. My brother and I had very different outcomes coming from the same environment.
I guess what I'm concerned about is if you'd had a lower class upbringing, the odds are that even if you had the genes for having a high IQ, that you would not have a high IQ.
It's quite possible. But I think the point that Charles Murray makes that I agree with is that you shouldn't have to have a high IQ in order to have a tolerably decent life in our society. And if IQ definitely is sorting people according to outcomes, that we need to correct for that somehow.
Yeah, I have no objection to that at all. That's not the part I disagree with. I think we could do a lot better, and there are probably a lot of potentially very intelligent people who aren't realizing their potential because they're unlucky enough to be born into poor families.
Well, I absolutely agree. I mean, my facility with language didn't come until, you know, high school, when I basically discovered the joys of reading. And I definitely could have had a different life path where I never discovered that, you know, I could access material in books that was considered inappropriate for somebody of my age. You know, if I had never discovered that, I probably wouldn't have the facility for description that I have, or, you know, my vocabulary or my ability to articulate complex thoughts on the fly. All of that came from reading, you know, and writing.
Yeah.
So I easily could have gone through life and never discovered that. I completely agree. But what I see is a lot of people who are very opposed to Charles Murray and who just get angry at hearing his name and think that it is, you know, violence is justified to prevent him from speaking in public. They haven't read his work. They haven't listened to anything he said, but somebody told them that The Bell Curve is a book about how white people are smarter than black people. And as far as I understand it, most of the comparisons that he was making in the book are between white people. That there is at one chapter
least,
that touches
at least
on
half.
That.
Yeah, at least half of the comparisons. Yeah. Well, okay. So I guess there's two things we could, two tangents we could go off from here. And the one is, should we be spending a lot more to make sure that the potentially very intelligent children in the lower classes get a chance. I happen to think so.
I have no objection to that, sir.
No, I don't.
But I also think that people who, you know, be it because they got thrown into the Sahara rather than into Iowa, or because, you know, they were a fairly deficient colonel in one respect or another, mm-hmm. nobody should be relegated to a life of desperation and poverty and basically being told by people who are doing better than they are that they should have tried harder, or, you know, that it's their fault. Okay.
So that was a short tangent because we both agree. Then we go to the other thing, which is, okay, yeah, it seems like in the kind of world we have at the moment, that being less intelligent, however you got that way, mm-hmm. nurture or nature, is a bad thing.
Oh, it's a bad thing in terms of your outcome.
Yes. Okay. You're not going to have as good outcomes. And I have no objection to, but how do we do that, I guess, is the question. And the that being, how do we ensure that someone whose intelligence is less than another person doesn't end up living, you expressed it very well, but a miserable existence? And that's the question. And I wasn't too impressed by what Charles Murray had to say about that in the book. And I wish I had taken time to reread that chapter now because I could make a better criticism. But, okay, and let's deliberately take a detour through some political and ideological things for the rest of our hour here. And that would be, again, he might object to this, but I would say that what Murray's saying is, fine, there are some things that could be done, and he talks about a couple of things, but suspiciously to me, they're all things that aren't going to cost him any money or people at his class, if you will, economic class. It isn't going to hurt them at all. Everything he suggested was save some money because we're not wasting college slots on people who aren't going to do good anyway. We're going to get rid of the welfare state. We're not going to waste any money other than maybe some universal basic income on these folks. And he has suggestions about how they can, you know, set up their communities so that they all feel like they're worthwhile people. I'm under-impressed. You know, I think more could be done. And in general, I don't know if you've noticed my politics, but I strongly believe in redistributing income from rich folks to poor folks, not enough so that I'm not saying level it completely, but past a certain income, mm-hmm. Wealth becomes a burden as much as anything, and it doesn't make you any happier. So why don't we tax away some of that income and help the less fortunate? Is that a far out kind of an idea?
Well, the ideological libertarian would say that what that would do is create a class of dependent people who have never known the benefits or the joys of work or personal initiative. And that you end up with a degraded class, which is, I think that's true to some degree. But right now, you know, wealth inequality has reached such absurd and unprecedented levels that, you know, I don't know of anybody who's ever made any sort of principled argument in favor of the current distribution that was at all compelling to me.
You know, good. But what about unprincipled arguments?
Well, I don't really feel much need to engage with unprincipled arguments, at least not for this audience.
But the people who are making them are being extremely successful.
Well, with Charles Murray, I think what you've been saying, or at least implying, is that he represents the interests of a very wealthy class. And that is true. I mean, his day job is, you know, a writer at a think tank somewhere and I forget the name of it, but you know, that's his explicit job, is to articulate a worldview which is beneficial to the hyper wealthy and which justifies the fact that they are doing so much better than so many people. I absolutely agree with you there.
Ah, good. In fact, I had some notes here, and one of the things I wanted to ask you, perhaps, is there a name, an ism, for those folks?
It is one variety of libertarianism.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would consider it more, you know, oligarchy disguised as libertarianism.
But, right. That's a...
You know, some libertarians basically are anarchists, and there are those who think that some amount of government is necessary, but just a little bit, and they are minarchists. Mm-hmm. But there are other types of libertarians or people who call themselves libertarians who say that, no, in order to have a society whereby, you know, contract is law and voluntary associations are law, you have to have an enormous, powerful state with a powerful army and powerful police in order to enforce those contracts. And, you know, to me, that's a Republican who doesn't want to pay taxes. You know, I want a big army. I want a lot of police. I want a lot of intrusion into people's lives. And I don't particularly care about the drug war. I just don't want to pay taxes, you know, and I don't want to have to pay for welfare programs. To me, that is not, I mean, that's libertarianism in name only. But, you know, it's not given to me the power to say who is and who is not a real libertarian. It's just,
you can express an opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that is not the viewpoint that would draw me to libertarianism. I mean, what initially drew me to libertarianism was the obvious moral failure of the drug war, that using the power of government to enforce some people's notions of morality, which are really just thinly disguised class prejudices, is, you know, and racial prejudices in some instances, is not legitimate. That is not a legitimate use of government. And, you know, that was my entry. And then from there, other parts of the story made sense as well, that many times the government's efforts to address social inequalities or social ills leads to new sorts of problems that would have not occurred, you know, had they done nothing.
Yeah. And no doubt that's true. But many times it works just fine.
What's the paradigm example of it working just fine?
Okay. Well, I'm sitting here in Canada, where, by the way, marijuana is now legal.
Sitting here in Vermont, where it's legal.
Yeah. Well, it's legal-er in Canada. I was just listening to one of your most recent broadcasts where you were discussing with the lieutenant governor the details of that. Yes. And it's legal.
You can't buy or sell here, but you can possess.
Yeah. Well, we can buy and sell, although they haven't exactly got that straightened out. It's the individual provinces in Canada get to set up their own mechanism for sales, and they're dragging their feet. You can buy it online from the province of Ontario, apparently. Don't know how that's working. Not interested. But anyway, the sky didn't fall in the day a few weeks ago. Game. Legal. So that's a real tangent. But the other one I would say is socialized medicine. A case where we pay taxes and the government uses the money to provide medical care at little or no cost to us. Works great. That'd be an example of I don't know. Could a libertarian argue that because I'm going to try and put my head in this gear, that because I know I'm not going to have to pay for medical care, that I won't take as good a care of myself? Because I know that it isn't going to cost me anything if I have to go to the hospital, do I not take good care of myself health-wise? Because, you know, not the consequences aren't the same. In the U.S., if I get sick, it can bankrupt me. We're here in Canada, it's not going to happen. So maybe I can be, you know, less careful about taking care of my health. I don't think that happens very much. I don't think that's a factor in how people, because being healthy is such a huge benefit in and of itself, that the fact that it doesn't cost you anything is, you know, not affecting, it doesn't come into people's thinking at all. So there's there we have an example of something that's done on a welfare state basis that works and works real well. That's an example. And and another tangent I'll go on, living here in Canada, while Canadians don't love paying taxes, we don't hate it nearly as much as I've observed Americans do. I don't know why that is, but it certainly puts a different spin on a lot of things politically. A politician can run in Canada and say that he's going to do such and such a thing, and we're going to have to pay for it, and he doesn't automatically lose for having said that. Where from what I've observed, and I must admit I'm guilty of watching American politics, it's some ways better than sports. You know, I'm not a big sports fan, so American politics fills that gap. It seems that if you were to make any sort of suggestion of something good that could be done, but only if we raise taxes, that would never fly. You couldn't get elected on that basis. Am I being unrealistically harsh there?
I don't think that, not unrealistically harsh, just a little simplistic. We have a very complicated situation here. You know, Hillary Clinton got more votes than Donald Trump did.
Yep.
But that's because the people who voted for her live in cities where, you know, which have high population density. And that's not how elections are conducted here. You know, we have an electoral college system. So elections turn on issues which are very specific to specific swing states. And so, you know, it's very rare that you can make a blanket statement about a mentality of the American voter, because we have, you know, like 7 different nations, really.
Yeah, for sure. It's a general, I'm generalizing, and my apologies for that. But that's, I don't know, I think if the people in a country in general are a little more willing to be taxed, to share with the less fortunate, then good things can come of that. And yes, there's always unintended consequences, and you can create problems as well.
Well, let me tell you about taxes in the U.S. I mean, if you're just a working person and you are employed by an employer and you fill out a certain type of tax form, then your employer is responsible for withholding your taxes, you know, what you owe to the government, and you never have to come up with that money. It's just automatically deducted from your paycheck.
Same here.
But if you are an entrepreneur or if you are self-employed, one, you get taxed at a much higher rate. So if I make a certain amount of money doing what I do, if I made that money in wages that I got from an employer, that then come tax time, I would get a refund from the government, because I would, my employer, to be on the safe side, would take more than I actually owe and send it to the government. And then at the end of the year, you know, we settle up accounts, and it turns out they owe me money and I get a check. But not having an employer, one, you know, I don't have access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. I don't have any sort of retirement plan. But more than that, come tax time, rather than getting a refund, I have to somehow come up with, you know, more money than I really have access to. I have to figure out some way to swing that. And it usually means several months of, you know, pretty severe austerity for me.
Yeah, I understand very well. My youngest son made a living as a guitar teacher for a number of years. And that was always a concern. Where am I going? Have I saved enough money to cover my taxes at the end of the year?
But in the United States, you know, we have corporations, hugely profitable corporations, which pay no taxes at all. And then if a working person owes a few $100 in taxes, they are hounded by the IRS. The IRS will seize the money in their checking account. You know, it might be $40 that somebody has in their checking account, and the IRS will seize it, leaving that person basically in the lurch in terms of, you know, paying rent or buying groceries or keeping the lights on. I mean, they're really viciously punitive on people at the lower end of the income scale, and make, and just give huge allowance to large corporate interests. So I have enormous anger at the IRS and at the federal government for the way it approaches income taxes here in the United States. And so, you know, maybe it's different in Canada, and, you know, somebody with different experience is going to have a different attitude. But my attitude is if somebody is proposing to increase taxation without addressing the unfairness of current taxation and without accounting for how they are going to decrease current spending in areas that I think are wasteful and immoral, then I'm not interested. You know, I'm certainly not interested. I am in favor of Medicare for all, you know, socialized medicine here in the United States, because it would be cheaper than our current system.
But yeah.
If somebody were to say, hey, KMO, all you have to do is increase the amount that you give to the government by 25%, and we can have, you know, nice health care available to everybody here, I'm like, forget it.
Because you haven't got the 25%.
I don't. I do not have the 25%.
But there's this thing, which doesn't seem to work, and that's not just the U.S., but the idea of progressive taxation. You know, you pay a lower percentage than somebody who earns twice as much as you. I guess it's there in principle, but the guy who earns twice as much gets to take advantage of all kinds of breaks.
Yeah, and he can also hire, you know, a high-priced tax attorney and accountants to comb through the absurdly complex regulations to find out how he can pay less. And it gets to the point where the people with the most end up paying next to nothing. And, you know, people with the least pay enormous amounts and are punished harshly when they are unable to keep up with that. So, I mean,
well, I don't think that's any different here in Canada. I think the CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency, your equivalent to the IRS, they're not known for being quite as nasty as the IRS is. Its reputation is, you know, even I've heard of what the IRS is like. The CRA is a little less nasty, but same thing, same principle. But I mean, the one thing I've noticed here in Canada, and I'm not here to say we're better than you, that's not what the purpose of this is, but we got problems, and I'll get to that in a moment. But we didn't go, and even when we had a conservative government a few years ago at the federal level, our equivalent of a Republican government, they didn't go around drastically reducing taxes. Somewhat, but not as much as has happened in the last couple of years in the States. So that's good, I guess. At the same time, we just elected a provincial premier, I guess the equivalent of a governor, here in Ontario, who is almost a clone of Trump. So I took a lot of the smug off me, I'll tell you. Most of your audience certainly doesn't care what the provincial government of Ontario is, so we won't go into that. But I'm not so smug anymore. And it's a major concern how these right-wing governments can get elected for me. I guess that's no surprise considering the way I'm talking here. But anyway, we're almost up to the hour, and it looks like we've run down on this. There was something on a totally different subject I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. In a podcast, probably months ago now, somebody was talking to you and asking if you'd ever heard of a board game called The Settlers of Catan. And your response was that no, you hadn't heard of it.
I've heard of it now, but I haven't played it.
Heard of it now. Yeah. Well, I hadn't, a few years ago, I hadn't heard of it either, but my oldest son went away to university and encountered it there and brought it home, and youngest boy tried it and loved it too. So my only comment I wanted to make was introduce it to your sons.
Is it a competitive game or a cooperative game? Is there a winner?
There's a winner.
Yeah.
There is, but it's comparatively speaking, say Monopoly. Mm-hmm. I loathe Monopoly because once you've started to lose, you're just there entertaining the guy who's winning.
Yeah.
It's not fun anymore, okay? Where Settlers of Catan is not near as bad that way. Yeah, somebody's going to win, but there's things you can do along the – even though you probably aren't going to win, you can still be in the game and having some fun with it. That's a pretty good board game. So,
well, The board games I've been playing with my kids are ones where it's all of us against the game.
Yeah.
That's because of the, you know, different aptitudes that my kids have, the older boy is always going to win any game that, you know, cognitive superiority, if it lends an advantage, the older boy is going to win.
Yeah. He can
think in a way that the younger one can't. Not that the younger one's stupid. It's just his other older brother is incredibly smart, you know, in terms of strategy and, you know, holding abstract patterns in mind and thinking ahead and that sort of thing.
Yeah. That, I would say, maybe a little less of an advantage, because my oldest son, who's almost through a bachelor's degree in, computer engineering, is pretty hot on math and all of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Better than me, and I always thought I was pretty good. And my youngest son is a bus driver, and he's pretty smart, but he's ended up being a bus driver. What he actually wanted to be was a heavy metal guitarist, but that doesn't pay the rent, you know?
Well, we've got somebody probably listening who is a bus driver.
And, yes. Yeah. And my son would be, if he listened to this, look, Dan, I'm not criticizing bus drivers. What I was going to go on and say though, was even though some people might turn up their nose that bus driving is a job, he regularly beats us all at Settlers.
Gotcha.
And he's a pretty sharp guy and still really good on guitar, although maybe not up to the level he was when he actually had a band. Anyways, so yeah.
Have you read any good science fiction recently?
I'm right now in the middle, close to the end of the seventh episode in the Expanse.
Ah.
Yes. I've watched the first 2 years of it on of the TV series, and then I started reading the books. I think there's eight altogether, and I'm on the seventh. I like space opera, and that's what it is, and it's good stuff.
Yeah. I have read the first few books in a series by a guy from Florida named Craig Allenson.
Mm-hmm.
And the books are called Expeditionary Force. The first one is called Columbus Day.
Yeah.
And they are very, very entertaining, I have to say. And fairly hard sci-fi. I mean, not to the level of somebody like Greg Egan, but, you know, certainly up to the level of somebody like David Brin.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
And this, from the title, I'm assuming this is sort of what you might call military science fiction?
Oh, it's definitely military sci-fi.
Okay. Yeah.
But very fun.
Yeah. Oh, I'll keep that in mind. Yeah. And what else have I read recently? I'm drawing a blank again. The last time you had me on the Sea Realm Vault, I did the same thing when you said I had swore I would have a stack of science fiction books. I got a stack of so many other books. If we're on the topic of books,
mm-hmm.
there's one called Debt, the First 5,000 Years.
Oh, yeah. That's a classic. It's several years old now.
Yeah, David Graeber. I read that this summer. And it's great. An anthropologist's take on economics.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's, really well worth reading. And then there's one that my eldest son lent me to read, and I ended up keeping it and had Amazon send him another copy. It's called Democracy in Chains. I don't know.
I don't know that one. Nancy MacLean.
Nancy MacLean, and it tracks a Nobel Prize winning economist who was mainly funded by Charles Koch, and it talks about, and that's where my negative opinion of Charles Koch's kind of libertarianism comes from to a large extent.
As I understand it, both Charles and David Koch largely have fossil fuels to thank for their wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's not a human being in the world who created fossil fuels.
That's true.
That is a resource that arguably belongs to everybody. So it is, it's pretty aggravating to me that it is a source of enormous wealth for some people, and that not as much in the United States as elsewhere, but pretty much everywhere where there's enormous mineral wealth under the ground, about the last people to get a piece of it are the ones who live on that particular piece of ground. That, you know, there's this thing called the resource curse, which is to say that if there's something really valuable underneath your feet, very powerful interests from afar will come and fight over it. And, you know, you don't know which of them will win the contest, but you know that you will be the absolute loser.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly true in what you'd call developing countries in Africa and South America and so forth. Yeah. Certainly not a good news if they've found some valuable mineral underneath your backyard. That's
right.
True. A lot of people even say the same thing here in Canada, because to a large extent, we've been a resource exporting nation, and the money goes away with the resource. It doesn't seem to end up here for sure. So that was the two books I had within arm's reach that I've read, and I can recommend them both. I had another one here, and perhaps you can, this is, I'll try holding it up. It's called IQ, A Smart History of a Failed Idea.
Who's the author?
Stephen Murdoch. He looks at the history of IQ testing, mm-hmm. and where the test came from, and how badly that's worked in a lot of cases. It is not a scholarly work. It's written by a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, well, I agree with a lot of what he has to say. I wouldn't recommend him as proof of anything. But some interesting ideas.
If it's written by a journalist, it's probably pretty accessible and readable, right?
It is, very, very much so.
That's what I expect from books written by journalists.
Yeah, it is. And all kinds of examples of where IQ tests didn't work very well. And I'm sure he holds to that opinion, which I don't agree with, which is that all an IQ test measures is how good you are at doing IQ tests. I know you don't agree with that, and I don't either. There's something there. There's no question there's something there.
It measures something.
Yeah. Whether G exists, this general intelligence or not. I have a paper here in my stack of ones I've printed out on the subject of IQ where they look at what if there isn't really a G, but there's a whole bunch of different abilities in the brain dealing with different aspects of what we lump together in G. And they did some simulations. And if these things are even slightly correlated with each other, you end up getting something that looks statistically like G. So it doesn't matter.
G, for people who are not versed in the literature, is basically just it stands for general intelligence. It is basically the idea that there is one cognitive capacity called intelligence, and that it can be measured, and that thing that is being measured is called G.
Yeah. And interestingly, the one thing I did find is that I think it's pretty well accepted among psychologists. I guess maybe the right term is psychometrists, people who measure IQ, that G can really be divided in two things: fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence. And younger people are getting by mainly with fluid intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And an old guy like me, his fluid intelligence has probably tapered off a fair bit, but I've learned a lot of stuff along the way.
Yeah.
That's crystallized intelligence. So I managed to still hang in there, even though my fluid intelligence, and I noticed this for sure, no question. I'm 64, going on 65, and there's a lot of things my head doesn't do as good as it used to. But because of experience, because of experience, you can get by pretty well. So there's those two different parts of intelligence, yeah.
Yeah, there seem to be a lot of different capacities wrapped up in intelligence. I would say even more than two. I mean, there's a different axis where you can cut it up. And for me, it seems really obvious that there's a difference between the ability to describe the world with language and the ability to describe the world or manipulate symbols with mathematics. They seem to be very different cognitive capacities.
They are
really good at one and really bad at the other. Whereas other things seem to be more tightly linked. Like if you're really good at math, it seems there's a high probability you'll also have some musical talent. Mm-hmm. And, I have always, from the time I was a kid, liked to draw. And for a very long time, I wanted to make my living as a cartoonist, and, you know, drawing mostly like superhero comics and things like that. Yeah. And I have taken a lot of art classes over the course of my life. And I think there's a certain level of ability to visualize how things are arranged in space that I'm just never going to have. Because people who have a lot less training and a lot less, practical experience drawing than I have just do it a whole lot better than I do. You know, some of them teenagers.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet, of course, so you're putting a whole lot of effort, you're saying, into your comic strip.
Well, I put a lot of time into the comic strip. I mean, the effort that I put into learning to draw is decades in the past now.
Yeah. But the time you put into, then you're saying there may be someone else who just has the innate ability to do that with less effort, less, or take less time at it, perhaps.
Yeah, a 17-year-old who can draw better than I can't possibly have had as much education and experience as I do.
Exactly.
And yet they're better at it, which is infuriating.
Oh, for sure. There's no question of that. Although, one thing that in that book by Richard Nisbet, Intelligence and How to Get It, he does draw a contrast between two extremes of the way of looking at things. And the one is that either you got it or you don't, you know? My dad was always like that. You're never going to be able to do that. You don't have the talent, you know, or someone else does and they will do it. And then there's the other extreme is where work at it and you'll get it.
Well, and this has come up in the topic of comedy for me, mm-hmm. because I've encountered people who say, you know, look, you're either funny or you're not. And I've read books by authors who say, no, you can get better at it. Here are some things you can do.
Yes,
to
you
get
can.
Better.
Yeah.
You know, now, regardless of your talent.
If you work really hard, though, and realize all your potential, there'll be somebody else who will have more potential and works really hard, too. And they'll end up at a higher pinnacle than you will. Like, occasionally, I'll do something that makes my wife laugh. And I don't mean, I mean with me, not at me. We all do the other, but with me, you know. Right. But on the whole, I'm really not a very funny guy at all. So I'm of low potential there, I would guess, even when I try.
Well, there are things you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a book. Gosh, what's the book called? I think it's called The Comedy Toolkit, How to Be Funny Even If You're Not. Who's the author? John Voorhouse is the name of the author.
Okay.
And I've seen a few YouTube interviews with him where he's talking to people I've never heard of. So apparently, you know, he's the kind of guy that he's looking to sell books and he'll do an interview with anybody who's willing to do one. So I've been meaning to get him on the show for a while now.
That'd be good.
Haven't done it yet, but I definitely intend to. He has a joke that, his last name is Voorhouse, which sounds like whorehouse. So
yes. He's
decided that, you know, he's got a joke. He says, well, I've been tired of having people tell me that my name sounds like whorehouse my whole life. So I'm going to change my name to Vordello.
Yes. And then he tells you why that's funny, I assume.
Well, he doesn't have to.
He doesn't have to. Well, there's no question that it is funny, but I'm sure if you want to get technical about it, you can analyze an example. Anyway.
Well, I think our connection is going south, so we might as well wrap it up.
Yep.
But Irv, thanks so much.
And thank you, sir, for listening to my ideas.
We will talk again.
You bet. Bye-bye. Bye for now.
All right, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks so much for subscribing. I will talk to you again quite soon. Stay well.